Welcome to Other Story, Western Australia's own environment program, this 23rd of July 2014. I'm Elizabeth Poe. You will have heard it somewhere. Last Thursday, Australia claimed another first by abolishing the price on carbon, with the Senate agreeing to the coalition government's repeal bills, 39 votes to 32, Labor and Greens opposing. But while self-described conservationist PM Tony Abbott is claiming a victory, there were three other significant actions on carbon emissions that remained in force. Despite clearly being in coalition sights, these three, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, the Renewable Energy Agency, and the Climate Change Authority, still continue to function, and there's a reason for this surprise outcome. Somehow, Clive Palmer, the mercurial leader of his own party, was convinced by Al Gore, former US Vice President, to preserve three out of four of these institutional actions on climate that may yet still help us move to a post-carbon future. And somewhat instrumental in achieving this outcome was some fancy strategic footwork by Ben Oquist, a former Greens chief of staff to both Christine Milne and Bob Brown. He gave Clive Palmer some unpaid advice, and it seemed to have worked beyond anyone's imagining. The mainstream media, particularly the Murdoch press, have focused on Ben Oquist's role, but there's very little they have to say about the work of the Australia Institute, where Mr. Oquist works as Director of Strategy. The Australia Institute claims to be one of the country's most influential progressive think tanks. Based in Canberra, it conducts research on a broad range of economic, social and environmental issues in order to inform public debate and bring greater accountability to the democratic process. Today on Understory, we go to Canberra to meet with the economists who do the research that matters, that makes a difference, at the Australia Institute. As you'll hear, the Australia Institute puts corporations and political parties to the test, bringing research and analysis that would otherwise not have been available to us ordinary citizens. At their fifth-storey office in Civic, Adrian Glamorgan interviews Australia Institute researchers to find out how the work gets done.
My name is Rod Campbell. I'm an economist at the Australia Institute. The main focus of my work is on the mining industry. I first came across the work of the Australia Institute well before I was here and looking at the mining industry. I felt it was really the only independent economic assessment of the industry in general and occasionally specific projects that was in the public domain. And I think that goes for a number of aspects of our work here. I don't think there's enough progressive voices within Australian debate. I often think that political parties and NGOs underperform on that front. And so I think the Australia Institute provides a lot of the intellectual muscle behind progressive politics in Australia. In terms of my work, I was quite involved in a report we put out about 3 weeks ago looking at state government assistance of the mining sector in all states and Northern Territory. And through some fairly painstaking research through state government budget papers, we found around $18 billion worth of measures over 6 years that state governments contribute to the mining sector, spent either occasionally giving money directly to companies, more often providing infrastructure, and often providing cheap access to that infrastructure. So I think Western Australia is in a fortunate position that it has a well-developed mining industry that contributes around 17% of state government revenue. And so I think the Western Australian government needs to invest that into the areas of the Western Australian economy that return the most to the people of Western Australia. And that tends to be through investments in health and education and perhaps in renewable energy, into things that return to the people of Western Australia and to the Western Australian community, not just into things that return to the mining industry. There's some amazing examples within the Western Australian budget papers where the Western Australian government has, I think it's around $340 million in a special account waiting for the Okajie project to maybe one day go ahead. That $339 million could be used to improve health and education in Western Australia, which would have a much better longer-term return to the people of Western Australia than leaving it sitting there waiting for another, you know, former hairdresser to try and build a major iron ore port. I think Western Australia's lucky to have the mineral resources it's got. I don't think it necessarily taxes them and gets the most out of them that it could, but it certainly should be putting that back into the community, not just into the mining industry. The WA coal industry is a very minor event in the story of Australian coal. Queensland and New South Wales are by far more important. But every now and again you do hear proposals to mine coal in the Kimberley or to further the coal industry. And I mean, coming from the East Coast, where you've got the world's biggest coal port in Newcastle, huge projects proposed in the Galilee Basin, where everyone's struggling to make money and looking at whether or not the long-term future of the commodity is sound in the home of Australian coal, and then at the same time to hear about proposals which must surely be financially very, very marginal in what seem to be very sensitive Indigenous and environmental areas, particularly in the case of the Kimberley, and it beggars belief that projects like that are getting the time of day from state governments. The idea that some of those coal projects would contribute significantly to the state relative to the damage that they're likely to do to some of those areas, the idea is preposterous. And I think a state like Western Australia, I mean, with the renewable energy resources that it's got in terms of wind and solar potential, the amount that's being invested into some of the state-owned fossil fuel generators relative to what's going into renewables, I think is far too small. And the continuing tacit support for a coal industry, I think is very misguided.
That was Rod Campbell reflecting on a report from the Australia Institute about massive state government subsidies to mining that raise as many questions as they do mining profits.
I'm Matt Grudnoff. I'm the senior economist at the Australia Institute.
Why is the Australia Institute important for Australians?
Oh, I think we're very important in that we occupy a very unique space. We're sort of a crossroads between academia and public policy. And I think that's sort of an important, and there's not many people in that space. So our role is to come up with new ideas, to look at policy and try and advocate for that policy.
Why did you choose to work here?
Well, I think I chose to work here because it's probably the most interesting job I've ever had. I can come into work and if there's something that I'm passionate about or interested in, I can do research into that. Whereas I've sort of worked in for government departments and I enjoyed that work as a public servant, but this job has so much more freedom to look at things that really matter and things that I'm passionate about.
Well, can you talk about some of the things that you most enjoy doing at the moment?
Sure. So just released a report recently on the renewable energy target. The release of that report was helped by John Hewson and Clive Palmer in Parliament House. And that was quite interesting to watch the political debate around the renewable energy target change, particularly when Clive Palmer decided that he wasn't going to support change to the renewable energy target. And just being a part of that was really fantastic.
Well, before we leave the renewable energy target, can you explain to our listeners what was at stake recently with that issue?
Sure. So the government had reviewed the RET and they sort of handpicked a group of sort of climate sceptics and big fossil fuel interests and free marketeers to do it. So it really looked for all the world like they had a particular agenda in mind, and that was to either scrap the RET or water it down significantly. And the renewable industry was quite concerned, and people who were interested in climate policy were quite concerned about this. So having Parliament or the Senate look like it had the numbers now to block any significant change to the RET was great news.
What does the RET give us?
Well, if the RET is untouched, it'll give us 41,000 megawatt hours, or about 20% of our renewable energy by 2020. So it's basically moving away from fossil fuels, from carbon dioxide producing energy to renewable energy.
Well, what does the economics say about going towards renewable energy rather than fossil fuel? Isn't there a lot of money to be made from digging up stuff from the ground?
Well, there is certainly a lot of money to be made at the moment, but as the world moves towards taking serious action on climate change, then there's going to be less money in fossil fuels. And right now, renewable energy actually has the capacity to lower electricity prices, and in the next few years, wholesale electricity prices will drop significantly because of the renewable energy target, and that'll flow through to prices that you and me pay. And most of the big energy consulting firms have modelled this and come to the same conclusion, and that is that in the next few years the renewable energy target will make all our electricity cheaper than if the RET didn't exist.
I didn't read about this in The Australian recently.
No, I don't get a lot of coverage in The Australian, but that said, we do get a fair amount of media coverage from all sorts of forms, TV, radio and the newspapers, but certainly there are certain parts of the media that are less interested in what we do.
Well, perhaps you can help demystify economics. What's at stake in the study of economics in terms of planning for Australia's future?
Well, I think economics is a great little toolbox for understanding the economy. And I think it's a most misused toolbox. I think there's a lot of self-interest and lobby groups that use economics as a way of trying to force their particular agenda on it, particularly business lobby groups like to use economics and misuse economics in order to get their own way. And most of the time when they're talking about economic arguments, they're talking about things that will make them more profitable, not necessarily things that will make the economy as a whole better off.
Well, we talk about the economy, but if we go broader, if we pan back and see environment and this whole sustainability picture, how do you see the way economics fits into having a sustainable Australia?
Well, I think that an economy, a strong and vibrant economy is important, but an economy is just one part of how we organise our life. And for an economy to be vibrant and to create jobs and to create wealth and to make people improve people's living standards, then it needs to be sustainable. Economics 101 says that, you know, if you're depleting a resource without paying for it, then you're going to overuse that resource. And in this case, if that resource is the environment, then that's not sustainable and that's not good economic sense. So economics by itself says that things like the environment should be included in as part of it, and if you overuse the environment and you deplete it, well then you won't have a vibrant economy at the end, and everybody will be worse off.
Matt Grudnoff, Senior Economist. The Australia Institute does extensive research on topics of interest to many different people.
Yeah, my name's Cameron and I'm a research assistant. I began here as a volunteer, actually. I started as a uni student. I was studying political science, and I had an interest in the things that the Institute was talking about. And I noticed as well that there was nobody else who was doing the same thing. So I wanted to make sure that I was contributing to, in any way. I come from quite a politically in-tune family, and so this has always been the things that we'd discuss around the table, and I thought that it's a natural extension of that, is to my studies and my background is just to be here doing what I can.
So what do you see the Australia Institute doing that matters so much to political life?
Sure. Well, I think that it's important that debate is not led by those who have a vested interest in seeing one side proclaim victory over the other. I think it's important as well that the role of debate is supported by important research. And oftentimes it's very difficult for politicians or for industry groups or unions to be providing the sort of research that's required to lend that ballast to arguments and ideas that need championing. So fundamentally, I think the Institute's best work is done when it's leading an issue or leading an agenda, and it's doing that because the research points it there.
Are there any particular perspectives that you think young people would be interested in the work that the Australia Institute does?
Tremendously, tremendously. You know, fundamentally, young people are people, and there's a lot of things which everybody in Australia has an interest in one side of the ledger or the other. So young people are no different. And I think one of the values of places such as the Australia Institute is that we don't pander. We don't say that young people are only interested in their iPhones and their movie tickets and all these sorts of things. So it's far more diverse than that. So we treat young people as intelligent people. I think that there's the differences between between the age of your audience is far overblown when it comes down to their core interests. So things like energy, you know, climate change, making sure that there are diverse political voices. These things are incredibly important. Their importance is not determined by your age.
There's a concern that the argy-bargy of politics has caused many Australians to develop a lassitude about politics, that they don't really particularly care. How does the Australia Institute contribute to reconnecting people to the political debate?
Well, we throw events, we ask our supporters, our generous, very generous supporters, and hopefully, if you're listening, then feel free to join our ranks. We ask them regularly, what are you interested in? What would you like the Institute to be doing more of? We have an active social media presence and we respond to what's being put out there, any challenges, any questions or queries. We know fundamentally that it's very important that anybody who is interested in the debate and wants to see their voice recognised should feel that there is an avenue for that. So the Institute's job, first and foremost, is not to push an agenda, but it's to reflect the agenda of its supporters. And our supporters are very diverse. And as a result of that, we have a lot of people who are saying we should be focusing more on this and more on that. And obviously, as a place with limited resources, we can't do everything. So it's very important that we reflect what our supporters want us to do. That's representation in its purest form.
Well, as a young person working as a research assistant here, what do you notice about the buzz of the office and the kind of people that are working here that you value?
Actually, this isn't a young person's paradise. This is in terms of at least the office dynamic, this is not a place where everybody's playing ping pong in the afternoons or putting their feet up on the tables. It's a place where we take what we do very seriously. And that's, I think, that's a good thing. But having said that, you know, I'm a young person. There are other young people who are employed here, and it's been the flexibility that's allowed the Institute allows us is tremendous. I've been able to pursue areas of interest that perhaps wouldn't have already been on the agenda. And I think that there is a lot of value for organisations such as ours that bringing on a diverse range of staff is you know, makes that difference. So, you know, we have people running the full gamut of ages here and we're better for it.
Well, thinking over the last year, what particular issues that the Australia Institute has taken on have particularly excited you personally?
We ran a campaign in the months preceding the federal election in September, saying that there are 1.4 million young voters who had not felt that their voice was being represented. And 1.4 million voters, when you think about the Australia's voting population, is a tremendous number. Often, you know, there are 40% of voters who are always going to vote for one side of politics, and there's 40% going to vote for the other side. So that 20% who are not feeling engaged at all have an untapped potential to decide how Australia's political future is determined. And many young Australians hadn't registered or weren't aware of what the parties stood for that was interested to them. So we surveyed young people. We said, what do you want to see more of? And we got tremendous results. We said things like same-sex marriage and things like affordable housing, university. And these things became agenda items. Young people who were engaged set that agenda. Neither party was willing to talk about same-sex marriage until Kevin Rudd went on Q&A and mentioned that he had an about-face and supported the idea, and that way it's what he ran on. But nobody was talking about this until young people started talking about it. Now, that's democracy in action. You see that happening, and that's as a result of us lending the voice of the Institute to the voice of young people. That's tremendously exciting.
David Richardson, Senior Research Fellow at the Australia Institute.
Why is the Australia Institute important to us in Australia?
We're unique. There's no other institution in Australia that is independent and looks at issues in Australia from a progressive perspective. There's other places around that are supported by big business because they tend to promote a free market view or a pro-big business view. But there's very, very few other independent researchers who are not conflicted. It's very interesting, even in academics these days. Most of them have knowledge in a particular industry area, for example, are holding out for contracts and consulting for big business. There's no other source of independent funds. If you're interested in a particular area, you have to go where the money is. So sometimes I think that I'm alone in Australia, about the only one that opens up bank annual reports and things like that, who's not conflicted.
So where does the Australia Institute get its funding that gives it such independence?
It all comes from donors. A small amount from sort of like consulting fees, but we only ever take on projects that we would have done ourselves anyway. It tends to be projects that we would have done if we had the chance to get around to it, that sort of thing.
So what are some of the projects that you've worked on that have meant the most to you?
The work we did both in mining and banking have been some of the most important, I think. Banking as an example of an industry that's very concentrated, one of the most concentrated in the world, and as a result is able to extract huge profit out of the Australian community. And, this is at the cost of ordinary home buyers, ordinary people that have to have a bank account in these modern times. So that becomes one of those areas where, a little bit of economics helps you address a very important social issue, mainly the question of who's ripping off who in modern Australia.
When we look at the banks, many of them hail their approaches towards sustainability. Do you think they could be doing a little bit more in the social responsibility and earth care departments?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Certainly in terms of social responsibility, the scandal now involving the Commonwealth Bank is just outrageous. The idea that the Commonwealth Bank, was one of the most trusted institutions in Australia, could be involved in, ripping off people's lifetime savings by employing people that are subject to very, very serious conflicts of interest. Their own kickbacks versus looking after their customer. It's to somebody with, perhaps a bit of an old-fashioned view of what banking should be. Banking should be something safe, solid, conservative. And I'm sure most people in Australia still think that. But to see that perverted as it is these days is just incredible. So, yes, cleaning up their act in that way, it goes right into the teller-customer relationship. Ordinary tellers are motivated by cash payment to try and put customers, in the direction of taking out more business with that particular bank in various sorts of things, including these wealth management products. Wealth management is an area that the banks traditionally weren't in, but would love to be. A bit of a vacuum after AMP insurance and stuff like that. But look, that's the most dramatic example at the moment.
Do you ever get any pushback from the industry about the work that you're doing that gives you a picture that actually you might be well on track?
Yes. Yes, we do. That left-wing think tank that wants to undermine the industry. But it's very interesting because they're quite happy to slur us like that, but without addressing our questions. That's not addressed. Nobody wants to take that up with us. to argue the technicalities of some of the bogus claims they've been making. They would rather just assert, and if anyone questions, they will impugn their motives.
The Australia Institute does extensive research on topics of interest to many people. Check out their very topical publications with groovy graphics available online, including Fighting Dirty on Clean Energy, Income and Wealth Inequality in Australia, briefing notes about bank investments in coal projects, as well as state government assistance to the minerals and fossil fuel sector. Thanks to David Richardson, Matt Grudnoff, Rod Campbell and Cameron Amos from the Australia Institute for joining Adrian Glamorgan and me at Understory this week. If you'd like to hear this program again or any of our earlier ones, search Understory, blog and RTR, and there you'll find a list of our recent past programs for your listening pleasure. Join us next week when there'll be yet more to explore on Understory.